Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
The Word is proud media partner of Latitude Festival.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
I don't know if there's any sense of, it is vaguely damp. This has always been vague. This is one of those shirts that is always vaguely damp. And I quite like vaguely damp. I'm a big Smiths fan. To be constantly, you know, vaguely damp is the correct way to be.
So, Robbie, question we've been asking everybody who comes up to this this table this weekend is when did you first go to a festival? When did you first take note of a festival?
I think I'd waited for a long time, and then when I was 19, I think it was, I went to Glastonbury and was so naive that I believed the best place to camp would be, oh, you know, really near the main stage and where all those men are weeing, which is what a lot of people do when they first... I mean, festivals have changed so much now. You hear... It's like whenever I hear someone either saying, oh, Latitude's really middle class, isn't it? Yeah, because the rest of the outdoor festivals are so known for their predominantly working class, you know.
Really?
Oh, I presume... And all these poets always go on about it, go, oh, yeah, because you poets, you love playing to a full-on footballing audience, don't you? Yeah. Who are that's what you love for your iambic pentameters.
So what year was it that you first went to?
I think it would have been 1990. I think
who
it was
the big bands then?
The big bands were the Happy Mondays, who I have seen. I saw last year. I say I saw them last year. Witchwood. It was literally it was Shaun Ryder and some people who played the songs. But they hadn't really changed because the amazing thing, the Happy Mondays were what a mess. I mean, such a mess in effect. And then the other weird thing, because the Happy Mondays were playing Glastonbury, Sinead O'Connor, who was wonderful,
Fat Slags t-shirt.
Fat Slags t-shirt.
Famously, yes.
And someone, when she was singing Black Boys on Moped, there were people shouting out, if you don't like it, go back to your own country, which was a very odd experience to have in a field in Glastonbury, where I thought the ley lines kind of expunged, you know. But yeah, so the Happy Mondays were an absolute live disaster, which I think they predominantly were, which was still interesting.
That was the point of the moment.
Was the whole thing. Now, this is what we sound like with John Cale. I'll just turn that one down and that thing off. This is just us. What is this? This is some men in a tin. And then I saw The Cure, and I'd never really liked The Cure because there used to be that division between were you a Smiths fan, were you a Cure fan? Which way did you go with your particular hairstyle? And I have to say, for 2 hours, the Cure were phenomenal, playing a lot of Disintegration. And then there was someone who got slightly crushed in the crowd. And watching Robert Smith try and ask the audience to move back, and could the audience... I know you're not going to listen to me, but you know, if you could move back, because someone kind of being crushed. But it was, it was very. And since then, I've tried to go to as many. And I mean, the great thing now is I'm allowed to, you know, work festivals, so it's brilliant.
Being the terrible age I am, the first time I ever saw a comedy act at a festival was in 1971 when I saw Monty Python's Flying Circus come on between Slade and the Incredible String Band.
Wow!
And that, you can guess how old I was. And it didn't really work in a way, because now, of course, you know, you are segregated into comedy tents. Is that a good thing? I mean, surely, you know, in those days, you know, people were waiting to see Slade. They couldn't quite adjust to the Parrot sketch or whatever it was.
Comedy music is quite a hard thing. The guy who gave me the taxi driver on the way here said, are there any famous bands on? And I knew that he probably wouldn't know The National or anything like that. And I said, Suede. And he went, what, the original Suede, who did Merry Christmas? I went, no, Suede. And he went, oh, right. He was quite disappointed. I think he's going to spend the weekend in Dis, to be quite honest. But, I love mixing the two. I mean, I do. In the literary tent, I've kind of, you know, I've done stuff with Robin Hitchcock, and I love doing things where musicians and comedians and other performers all come together. But actually, if you have, you know, the famous stories of, you know, Matt Lucas supporting Blur, etc., it's very hard for an audience. And recently, you know, Belle and Sebastian had Daniel Kitson and Gavin Osborne supporting them, which is perfect because, of course, you know, Gavin and Daniel create these beautiful, melancholy stories. And I know a lot of people really enjoyed it, and certainly no one booed. But even then, I think there is a discombobulation between we're here to hear the boy with the Arab strap, not a 60-minute...
gear change, isn't it? But you started out with...
Burkhoff with Echo Belly was wonderful.
Horrendous thought.
A horrendous thought, but I would like to do it. Do you think Latitude will give me the money?
This is the place, I would have thought.
One of the saddest things was Echo Belly. What was her name?
Sonia.
Not Sonia. Who was the there was a bass player who originally hadn't been with them. And then she went on, I think, to maybe even briefly be in My Bloody Valentine. She was in a band called Slow Pony as well. No, she was she was kind of like quite a short, tight, cropped hair lesbian.
Come on, Craig.
I'm going to make this.
We've got some rock critics in the audience here.
But
I wish
I could remember her name, because a mate of mine saw her on the bus the other day and went, "Oh, it's really sad when you see someone that you remember from." And she was still dressed beautifully in a suit, but she was on the bus and said, "I had a worse experience 10 years ago when I went to Nottingham Record and Tape Exchange, bought one of her albums and gave it to her to actually put through the register." Now, that was one of those. And I think she's terrible. Since then. And I didn't realise, because if I'd done that, I would not have bought the album. I'd have come back another day, because I knew the sense of embarrassment. Oh. But that bit of just her going.
Did it have one of those stickers on the top that says £10 crossed out £9
yes,
crossed out £8?
It was £5. And Slow Pony. What's Slow Pony? Was it Slow Pony or Snow Pony? Snow Pony. Great album.
You can tell we're at the Word podcast. We're talking about Snow Pony.
Yeah.
This is good.
Don't worry. It's not all going to be mainstream.
Did she sign the album for you? Or
No, I kind of skulked away, feeling vaguely embarrassed that I had created this situation and hoping that she didn't really notice.
She probably thought you'd done it on purpose.
Can we make sure we dub in her name later on? Because this is an even worse conversation.
Grotesquely disrespectful.
Yeah, Google. That's brilliant.
We're going to Google it live.
Not coming up.
That's just... We'll cut that.
There is a statue which is called the Echo Belly Lesbian, but it's a very different image.
Oh, God almighty. But no, look, but you've always tried to do quite complicated, quite challenging bits of broadcast and live performance. And I remember that you did with Book Club.
Yeah.
Am I right? Now, didn't people used to come along to the... bring books and present them to you? Explain the concept of Book Club.
Well, the idea was that I realised that from touring around for 10 years, I had built up an Oxfam Help the Aged, etc. collection of some really diabolically bad pieces of literature, the novels, self-help guides in particular. And so I'd got all these together, and one night I was a bit bored in Edinburgh, and I thought, well, I'll just read some of these Mills and Boons out while having some Philip Glass play in the background. I think it was a meeting of minds.
Yeah.
Rash Intruder and Koyaanisqatsi, or whatever it's called. I never know how to pronounce that. How do you pronounce it? Never call your film something you are embarrassed to ask for at the Odeon.
Koyaanisqatsi, isn't it?
Is it Koyaanisqatsi?
Think so.
Well, that's going to be the main debate.
A very
word
podcast moment.
But it was,
I know the answer, I'm just not saying.
Why didn't I just say Philip Glass's music for Dracula? That would have been much easier. Cut the other bit out.
We all know what Philip Glass sounds like. Yeah.
So it was basically because I started doing that, and I thought this is a good way of also bringing on variety acts and acts who do different kind of things, who wouldn't necessarily be able to do the comedy circuit, because that had become increasingly, increasingly male, certain kind of stand-up comedy. And so I thought creating something where you can... There's a wonderful group called Gorka Gogo who create these fantastic puppets and costumes. They play these characters. They did Liberani, who is half... Liberani is half the Terminator... and half Liberace, this wonderful felt costume.
Liberace,
and then slowly Liberace decays into the kind of burnt.
Brilliant flesh
and
just hanging.
Dolly Parton, who is a small version of Dolly Parton, whose breasts drop open to show different Dali-esque style images. Right? Now, in some comedy clubs, this would be taken, with a certain amount of, forceful hints as to leave, because they're not necessarily. And this was such a wonderful thing. I thought, I have to do things with people like this. And he's also a wonderful cartoonist as well, the guy does it. And so I thought, putting on things like that. And Elvis was probably their most famous thing. Elvis was the elephant man Elvis, who would come on wearing the Hessian sack and the hat, right? And then you would slowly hear... It'd start off with the music from the David Lynch film. Then it would turn into the Sprack Zarathustra, But then he would take off the cloak, revealing a kind of neurofibromatosis arm, and a kind of rhinestone costume, and then reveal a neurofibromatosis Elvis head, and then kind of do all this. Thank you very much. You've all been very kind. Thank you very much. And it was just, And it was such a wonderful, and so that was kind of the idea of it. And then obviously to write Killer Crabs musicals.
That's brilliant. But you went on the stage with these books, and I mean, were you going in there with no preparation at all? I mean, how little preparation do you go on with sometimes?
Well, as little as possible. I used to love the fact that, like, the Killer Crabs novels by Guy N. Smith, from Attack of the Killer Crabs to his latest one, which I think comes out soon.
Beast Man in Word, actually.
It's wonderful.
Yeah,
I mean, the books are, and he, with that, you can open it on almost any page. I on the last tour I did of Book Club, I did a kind of Mills and Boone bingo, where I would just say to people, I have no idea most of what's on most of the pages of Rash Intruder, but between page 5 and page 188, just shout out a number. If I know the page, we won't do it and we'll move on. And the favourite one I had was from Stormy Vigil, my first Mills and Boone. We all have one.
Yeah.
Where
classic.
It's a great one. It's, you know, it's Professor Lyle Hemming.
Yeah.
It's Sally. They're not getting on and they're in a lighthouse, right? You can imagine imagine a level of umbrage and sailor
terrible,
death.
Terrible drama and domestic grief. And it ends in a happy sunset with
two people
strolling off to a delightful future together.
No, I must. I don't know if I told my favourite line, actually.
Anyway.
There is a great line from the one set on the Outback Ranch where it has, I'm going to try and remember this off by heart. It goes, they finally realise Saxon McAllister, the farmer, who I might have mentioned in the previous podcast. Saxon McAllister and the woman Deborah are going to get married, they've decided. Yeah. And he says, that's it, when are you going to marry me, sweetheart? He questioned her fervently. Whenever you want, she replied. He then, what's it then? He says, the night of that damn storm, that was nearly my undoing. My God, I went in to comfort you, but if I'd stayed any longer, I would have ended up raping you. Now that is, and she then says, "Don't worry, it wouldn't have been rape, my love." And that's the challenge. That is the challenge, and that actually occurs in 1970s.
So yeah.
I always do from an early start.
All the same.
But yeah, Stormy Vigil had the Stormy Vigil had one where they're about to a hand is going up Sally's jumper, Professor Lyle's hemjumper, and it slowly, as it slowly worked up the soft of her belly, on one side the smoothness of the skin, on his knuckles the harshness of her woolen jumper, eventually reaching the lace of her bra. But before it could go any further, she grabbed his wrist and said, "No, Lyle, I need to take a reading from the barometers." So it's like, kind of, you know, you can't. So you have to take the risk.
It's made an enormous impression on you. I can't believe you're quoting.
My first novel will be. I'm trying to remember quantum mechanics. That's what I want to use my brain for.
You're saying all the adverbs. He said fervently. It's all unnecessary adverbs thrown in.
Do they still do that thing with Mills and Boone books where they used to give them a plan to write them and that certain things had to happen by page 45? And is that still
the case? It's all very much. I mean, it's interesting because friends of mine who are authors have tried to write a Mills and Boone thinking, how difficult can it be? But actually, I think you really have to believe in it so much, or at least be so detached from it, that there is a way of doing it as a piece of science, really. And so there are some people, there's a woman called Margaret Mayo. They write hundreds of them. Only one man, as far as I know, that's still correct, has written a Mills and Boone. And so you have to know at chapter one, normally, it's changed a bit, but throughout the 80s, it was predominantly, oh, why have I never found love? Who's this awful, arrogant Arctic explorer I've got to interview? Chapter two, I don't like this Arctic explorer, but I might go on this mission with him. Chapter three, God, but there's still something about him. Oh, there's something about her. Yeah. Chapter four, Frizzard. Chapter five, Kiss. Chapter six, we've done a terrible, terrible thing. Chapter seven, chapter eight, eating dogs or a sailor death or something like that. Chapter nine, we've been so silly, haven't we? that's it.
But we're still friends.
God,
you must
brilliant.
Be cursed with a terrible, you know, incredibly retentive memory.
But again, only for useless to try. I mean, I don't know.
Is that all it is?
I only.
What else can you use of sleeve notes of albums or what other things?
I'm not good. In terms of musical things, in terms of. I didn't know my left from my right until I was 8 years old. The reason I found out my left from my right was I bought Alan Frank's horror movies, which Mark Gatiss also talked about very passionately in his series. And I learnt my left from my right because I didn't know my left from my right, but I knew which was Boris Karloff in the Tower of London and which was Bela Lugosi in The Island of Dr. Moreau. So it would say, right, Boris Karloff in the Tower of London, left. And that's how I learnt my left from my right. So pop culture so goes through me like a stick
of rock. Unimportant things like left and right you couldn't do. But
yeah, I mean, I can still remember the nature of love, some ideas of quantum mechanics and a certain amount of Schrodinger's cat, but I'm not going to waste your time with that. Don't ask me, I'm very tired.
This is sensational stuff. Now, we're going to have some questions.
Oh, yes, questions. We have a roving mic,
Gareth,
I think.
Got a microphone.
But has Gareth got?
So he's going to go out and get a few questions. I have to just one quick thing. I have to interview Brendan Burns tomorrow
You're in the literary tent, aren't you? Yeah, I will be heckling all the way through.
Oh, heckle, yeah. Please heckle. And it's very, very interesting. Brendan Burns, as you know, stand-up comic, and he's very honest about rivalry between comedians. I won't ask you to get involved in that conversation because it's quite hard, but he is no problems at all about going on about how difficult it is, how this whole thing about joke theft, you know, that people nick out each other's material. But the thing he said is that he said the most difficult gig he's ever done is standing there and other comedians are in the audience and they're standing at the front and they're finding it impossible, they're refusing to laugh.
I totally disagree with that. He is really hated. I've known Brendan for years.
He says, if you're a comedian, you see another comedian laugh, I'll say, you take it as a personal affront to yourself. Incredibly ungenerous.
No, I think that's wrong. I totally disagree with him, and please allow me to ask that question when you're in the tent tomorrow. Because, actually, when I've compared it to, say, poets or actors or authors, I've generally seen... I'm always as rude to a comic's face as I am behind their back. I don't think I've ever been... And so I
stab them in the front.
Yeah, stab them in the front.
Ian Hislop would say.
I don't think there is a great... Some people get caught up in it. I think hopefully you reach an age where you go, the rivalry is pointless. I've got asked quite a few times in the last year, oh, what do you think about Michael McIntyre? And I don't really have a particular opinion because the likelihood of me in my kind of weird little gigs that I do talking about, you know, either science or Mills and Boone novels, I'm never going to be playing the O2. I'm never going to be really probably attracting what is his core audience. He's just doing a totally different thing to me. So I actually think you can avoid... And also, I think comics can be very generous. When they see someone maybe going through the same old routine that they know, they might go, oh, God, 10 years in, I can't believe he's doing that. But at new material nights, things like that, you will often find comics, you all have a chat together, oh, here's another idea for your joke. I find the ones that I hang around with anyway are all very generous to my face.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, that's very encouraging to hear. Now, Gareth, do we have any questions from the floor?
We were rehearsing this earlier by means of pointing out who was asking the questions. You know, the lady in red, the man in black, man with the child in his eyes.
Not that one in the
cocoon. The boy with a thorn in his side. Was it the man who shot Liberty Valance?
The man who shot Liberty
Valance.
Over
there, the lady, I love the lady in red. Yeah. What's Sir Andrew Collins doing? He used that gag. He said, any questions? The lady in red. Everyone looked around. There was obviously no lady in red. She said, sorry, I just always wanted to say that. She's the lady in red. It's brilliant. Any questions?
Oh, there's one over there from the human centipede. Now, that's unusual. I wasn't expecting that. That's a cinematic reference. It doesn't belong
six
here.
Parts.
Somebody over there.
Hi, Robin.
Hello.
My question is, what has Ricky Gervais done to you recently?
Do you know what? Ricky actually, fortunately, one of the great benefits of his enormous amount of fame is he doesn't have... now he can probably play pranks on, you know, Clint Eastwood or whatever. Oh, quick, go and hide in Clint Eastwood's wardrobe and jump out. So, fortunately, Hollywood has managed to take him... Because I still get asked loads of questions about... Some people still believe... For those of you... I'll fill this in, right? A lot of you may not know this, but I knew Ricky Gervais for years. We were kind of friends. I suppose we still are friends. I toured with him, and on the two tours, it was insane. There was an extra put on the first DVD we did where, when it was edited, there were a lot of things Ricky wanted to keep in, and the editor actually went, we can't keep that in. You look really, really like you're ill. You are psychologically ill. The reason that you're torturing a middle-aged man through these bizarre things, right? Very odd things would go on. He would do things like he would get his agent just to hide in my dressing room to burst out suddenly. But I knew all these things would happen. So here were these middle-aged men working with million-pound accounts. And I would just walk in the dressing room, open the door and go, Duncan, you can get out from wherever you're hiding. And a man would have to come out and go, oh, yeah, sorry, Ricky. Sorry. Ricky made me do it. And everyone becomes a kind of, you know, the puppet, basically. And so also I still get people ask me, they go, yeah, did you really have to sit on ham because you had worms when you were a child? Now, this is one of the things he made up about. Now, the annoying thing about that is, I made up that story about Ricky. He very quickly became famous and thought the best way of ruining this story is I'll go, my friend Robin had to sit on ham because he had... But I said that about too late. I'm famous. I win.
Yes. Yeah.
Robin used to drink milk from a cow's udder. But I made that one up about you. It doesn't matter. I'm famous. Everyone thinks it's you. Every single week, people are going, you're still drinking milk from a cow. No, I'm not. I never have. What the ham? And people, I mean, Carl Pilkington has famously once said there's no smoke without fire. And you go, well, no, some things are just made up, Carl. Some things are. And also, if as a child my parents had made me sit on some ham, it's one of those things that I'd probably keep back. I probably wouldn't go when I met new people, hi, I'm Robin. I don't know about you. I used to sit on ham. You know, that's
always breaks the ice at parties.
Yeah, at least save it for one of those top 100 kind of Channel 5 shows.
That's right.
Number 7 on top 100 meats.
Who used
ham?
To sit? That's right, yes.
Oh, God. Any more questions?
Yes, another question from the audience. Anybody?
Anybody?
When will it stop raining?
We'll know that soon.
When can we leave?
The rain is relentless. I'm sure, Fraser, can you hear the rain on the... Oh, you can't, OK. Because very loudly above our roof, it is rattling down.
So, Robin, you've done your gig. You came to hear...
I've done one of my gigs, yeah. I did the stand-up tent, which was... I was literally filling in because I was here anyway, and they said, would you mind doing a short set? And it's, I always find it a bit weird because it's playing to such a large number of people. I there were certain jokes that I wanted to do about things like the philosopher Peter Singer. And I often think this is not the right environment when there's 2,500 people for you to deal with. I mean, the philosophy world, Peter Singer is very well known as a reference point in the 2,500 people in a tent at Latitude. Less well known, but better known than if I was playing the Lovebox Festival attempting to do a joke about Peter Singer.
But you got away with it.
Yeah, I think so, but I'm sure so. I always imagine at least, you know, 50%, no, 15, no, 10. Oh, people might be listening to this, it might affect my work. But I always imagine about 15% of people leave a gig, unless they've specifically come to see me, leave going, oh, I don't get any of that. That is ridiculous. Why'd a man do that?
And it doesn't bother you at all.
Yeah, it bothers me a bit. I always imagine the person sitting at the front in a room has a really angry face. And then I look down at them quite often, they've been happy. I was doing a gig on the South Bank in the Udderbelly, the upside-down inflatable cow.
Yeah.
And it was all new stuff, and I was rattling on about Open University sadomasochistic programming with Heidegger, right? Which, it wasn't a deliberate thing. I hadn't written the idea. My inner monologue has a lot of control over me now. And I supposedly, lots of people tweeted me going, I really enjoyed it. But my partner went, I didn't get any of that. What is the point? And then I thought that's good because a lot of the show is about existentialism, and therefore, due to creating something which is disappointing for them, they have then now had to face up the disappointing nature of life.
Right.
So that's my mission. I'm the existential littlest hobo. Town to town, I bring despair. And then I leave again. That's it.
So you're filled into the stand-up tent. What are you doing anything else this weekend here?
Yes, I'll be doing the literary tent tomorrow. Today, in fact, I'll be doing this afternoon. We will have some chemistry experiments with a wonderful guy called Andrea Seller, and also Helen Arney, who's a very good singer-songwriter, and Matt Parker, who's a mathematician. So I'm doing a thing called Double Science, where I kind of do
Double Science. Good
double
mate.
Science. So it's just yeah, it's I love doing. So I do a series on Radio 4 with Professor Brian Cox called Infinite Monkey Cage, and we did one about ghosts, the last of the series, and we've had a record number of complaints from people saying that it was a very unbalanced show.
In what way?
Because we basically suggested that ghosts were perhaps an interesting figment of human imagination.
And I'll have to say
good thing. And,
so your feedback.
Spoiler! Oh no, why don't you put spoiler alert for irrational beliefs?
Burst the balloon.
But yeah, we had loads of complaints and people kind of saying that it wasn't balanced because there was a lack of ghosts and stuff like that. In fact, we did have one ghost on, but they didn't hear. And now it's become Knobbergate because Brian went, oh no, some people have been complaining to the BBC about the show, Knobbers. the Telegraph then went, a disgusting BBC employee, Brian Cox, has been calling everyone who believes in anything Knobbers. The other way they do remove some of the facts to make it a more interesting story. And also because he uses Knobbers without the K, so I think they're a little bit annoyed about the specific spelling.
Double disaster.
So what time is Double Science?
What time is it? I think it's 8:05.
Right.
Yeah.
And
then, then we're doing another one tomorrow evening as well with Ben Goldacre, who may well remember. Was,
I saw you on stage with in the Nine Lessons and Carols for Godless People.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a fantastic show. I love the idea.
He annoys your journalist, that Ben Goldacre, though, didn't he?
He did.
I love that.
I think he made her cry.
Yeah, that
June
is,
Rogers
of
this parish interviewed Ben Goldacre, and I think with tears, actually. It fell out. Didn't he read the article?
Yeah.
Was
I went, what did you do this time, you idiot? I was on his side, don't worry.
Well, look, thanks very much for being here this afternoon.
You.
Very good.
Robin Ince.
We have a very large hand, please, Robin Ince.
Did I talk too much? Sorry, I'm going to be
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
Hey. How's it going?
I think that the best thing to do, because there's so many people have been hanging around here to particularly to see you, and they've been filling in very entertaining fashion. Congratulations to our
the entertainment ends
concert
now.
Party. I think the best thing to do is to in a moment go and throw this open to the floor, actually, if anybody's got any questions. First of all,
we've got some questions.
All right. First of all, what's your first memory of going to a festival or being aware of a festival or seeing a festival on TV or anything like that?
I saw Pete Seeger at a very, very early age at a weird outdoor kind of hippie festival.
Right.
Like, it was really prime time hippie 1968.
Can you remember what he was playing?
He was playing the banjo.
Yeah. Big audience?
It's very small. It's very, very small. I mean, I don't know if it was a festival. He was playing outside.
And that's what struck you as a festival?
Yeah. Well, I was eight.
No, fair enough. What about you?
I don't think I ever went to festivals as a kid, but we played, one of the first ones we played was, I think, Roskilde. And in the tradition of unbearably rainy outdoor festivals, it was incredibly wet and muddy. But as I recall, Bob Dylan was there, and it was during that period in his career where he was performing songs that were internationally famous, but you couldn't tell what he was playing.
Right.
You'd be about halfway through the song, you'd be like, that's All Along the Watchtower. No, that's...
Masters of War. No. Yeah. Yeah, it was like stump the audience.
He's been doing that for a long time.
It's very exciting. But it was new to us.
So what have you learned? You've played, presumably, quite a number of festivals. What have you learned about playing festivals?
Ring wellies.
Yeah.
Ring wellies. We didn't learn that until 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But in terms of performing,
ring wellies.
You know, the thing about, playing shows in general is you can be very aware that a microphone, if you do a club show, you can do... you can do a dynamic performance where things get very quiet or very loud, and it all kind of can work. All those things are available to you. The strange thing about just having things scan, be understood when you're talking or singing, you actually have to kind of, sort of puff yourself up into arena rock size.
Yeah.
Which is, it doesn't come naturally, but you figure out how to do it after a while.
So there's no point being diffident on at a festival.
Well, what's weird is you try to do something subtle and it actually doesn't scan. Nobody notices. People don't notice.
I think Mussolini went through the same process.
Yeah.
He tried to be subtle and nobody noticed. And,
So when you play a show like this, are you having a different set list than you would normally do?
We have the Mussolini set list.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
what are the features of the Mussolini set list?
Well, the other thing is you can't assume that it's your crowd. You want to read... I mean, I just had an experience talking to a guy who's working these shows. He'd never heard of us before, and he was just like, you guys are so great. I mean, that was a great show. Like, who are you? Like, what do you do? And it's just like, I mean, it's a great opportunity for us to... we're often perceived as a cult... type band, like a band that you either like or hate, and I think it sort of behooves us to try to reach out to the people who think they're supposed to hate us and come over to our side.
Is it frustrating to say to people, well, we've been around for how long? 30 years?
Yeah.
30 years.
Well, I mean, 29, if you're counting.
Well, I mean, actually, in a way, a lot of the people that we're speaking to have not themselves been around for
right.
So there's always a process of getting new people interested.
Now, you, in the last few years, you've branched out. You've done some records for children, haven't you?
Yes.
Played shows for children. Has that helped seed a new audience in any way?
Yes. We're indoctrinating young.
It's hard to know how much they'll stick to it. Like, if they'll think like it's just some version of the Monkees or something. In their I don't know. It's hard to know if we're actually creating permanent fans.
Oh, right. I mean, this is potentially like something you like a lot as a little kid could become incredibly uncool by the time you're like 14. So right. there is that risk, I guess.
But I was told recently by somebody, who's like our age, there was this period like 10 years ago in the United States where a lot of sort of
outsider teens embrace the Beatles as a, I mean, we were playing that Beatles song, and I was sort of, they embrace the Beatles as sort of a form of unified otherness to, you know, they weren't climbing on the, to the Britney, you know.
It was alternative and not
like. Yeah, I mean, it's hard for us, to, I mean, having grown up with the Beatles, it's hard for us to think of them, the Beatles, as in any way, you know, it's like the
alternative.
It's like, yeah, it's like the God alternative.
Yeah.
But, but evidently, he was saying that he felt like now there was a kind of a similar, a smaller but parallel thing happening with teenagers and They Might Be Giants, which is a very strange idea for us. But I guess, I don't know, maybe we're sort of occupying the same place like Frank Zappa or Captain Beefheart or somebody like did in our teen years. You know,
so you get new generations coming along and they're looking at
various
the,
different
the landscape
stages,
of
yeah.
music in a
yeah.
totally different way.
Yeah. yeah.
What's your key song for doing for kids? You know, what's the one that goes over best with the small children?
Clap Your Hands is a pretty good unifying one because it's just like it's in the, you know, you don't, it's not about anything, it just is something.
Right, right. And do you find that audiences generally, and does this apply to children, they like something to do during a show that you
they like the confetti cannon. And they like the experiential stuff. I mean, they just, you know, they want to be alive.
Right,
know?
Right. And
they're new at it.
Right, right, exactly.
And do you adopt any of that with your grown-up shows?
Well, weirdly, we brought the puppet show into the grown-up show, and it's even more popular for the adults. I mean, we discovered yeah. very quickly.
Yeah. So, are there anybody? I think Gareth is wandering amongst you over there in the. In the green jacket. If there's anybody there,
hey, I want to thank everybody for sticking around. Like, I have to tell you, like we've been completely confused for about an hour, having no idea what this was or where we were going. So, thank you for being here. And I know we're officially New York uncool late.
Right. Is there anybody there who's got a question they'd like to put to the gentleman? Wally, while you're doing that, I've got a question. You've had quite a bit of involvement, quite a bit of success with songs that were used on TV,
yeah.
and commercials
well,
and so
well, we've
forth.
Well, we've done a lot of things. We've created a lot of material for television and commercials and movies. We don't get the really sweet deal is to get your song that already exists licensed for top dollar,
right?
You know, because then you don't really have to do any work, and hopefully it's attached to something super dignified. that's kind of like what we have in mind. But instead, you know, people call us up and ask us to kind of do their specialty thing, and those jobs are you know, some of them are good, some of them are a little bit difficult. We just got through doing this one thing that was pure
catastrophe,
pure torture.
What was that?
Oh, we're not going to say.
We can't say,
but we can tell you it's not going to happen.
Oh, really? So you got all the way along the line, and then it didn't happen.
Our manager has really perfected the whole kill fee thing.
Oh, good.
Because used to be that we would do these jobs, and the kill fee would be less than it would cost to make it. So it was like we were being punished to work for people who are being mean to us. I mean, it was like punishing on every level.
So what's the kind of classic...
It sucked.
What's the classic way that might happen? Somebody comes to you and says, I've heard a tune on your fourth album.
Not even that. We've got a thing that isn't working in our project. We want you to rescue it, but we don't know what we want. We just want something better, and we'll do a series of demos. And in this situation, it was demo after demo that wasn't somehow solving the problem.
You're trying to guess what it is that they
were
want.
Trying to
they
guess
don't
and
know.
They don't know.
It's sort of a unique to movies have this unique problem where there's a lot of like throwing money at things at the end to try to make them not be bad movies.
So we get called
in to save the bad movie from itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work.
Do you have to play this stuff to committees and so forth?
You have to have conference calls that are that involve people who are in the back of car services on the way to the airports, on planes, or, you know, like completely unintelligible Darth Vader voices. You don't know if they actually are Darth Vader or they just sound like Darth Vader because of their phone. Sometimes I think it's the former. But, it's very much by committee. It's a very much that stuff tends to be very show business stuff. But we're luckier than most because when we do get tapped to do original music, they either think that we're going to be versatile, which we can be, so they ask us to do different kinds of things, or they just like our general aesthetic. I mean, so we're kind of in the catbird seat. I mean, we have no right to complain, but we are happy to complain.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what's your most successful tune that's been used on TV? You did it.
Well, we did the Malcolm in the Middle song.
Malcolm in the Middle.
Which we got a Grammy for. And
what's it like going to the Grammys?
Super fun.
Well, super weird because, I mean, even after the third nomination, we felt like we were these weird double agents, like sneaking
around.
You weren't
supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like we're the what's wrong with this picture. I mean, especially when we won for Malcolm in the Middle because we were in a television and movie category. So it was like, I mean, thank God. You know, Pearl Harbor had a horrible theme song because I'm sure it would have been, if it had been even halfway okay, it would have won. It was like, you know, it's like Sting, They Might Be Giants, Celine Dion. And it's just like, we are not going to win this. Yeah.
But you must have done.
We did, we did.
Who did you win against? Who did you beat? You must remember.
We beat Sting.
That
was the list.
Yay. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, we that was a separate incident. We beat him. Yeah.
He was in the bathroom with Ike Turner. Ike knocked him down.
Yeah, he's very surprised.
Yeah,
the Grammys.
He's fit though. He is very fit.
I bet.
Yeah, yeah.
The Grammys have an immense number of categories, don't they? They keep trying to cull them every year, don't they? So they can get them down to manageable.
I think is wise. Until they cut the categories that we are eligible.
No, there is.
We have become aware that there are actually two children's categories because we won for the second Grammy we got was for a kids record, and there's an alternate category in children's records which is best children's spoken word. So if anybody's feeling ambitious out there. You know, it seems
that's the one to target.
Kind of obtainable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a greenfield site. That
yeah,
is.
Yeah. I mean,
I think
dreams come true.
Over here, this lady over here.
Okay.
Hi. Right. My name's Sarah Bonetto, and I'm
Sarah.
I'm a stand-up comedian from Australia, but I live here now. Now, 10 years ago, do you remember doing a gig in Melbourne where you played Flood in sequence, like the whole album Flood in order?
I was
at that gig.
Yeah.
Now my friend Andy, who's a stand-up from Melbourne, we got a set list after the show. Great, right? Great. He said, "Oh, I'll take it home in my backpack because you haven't got a bag." And he lost it. It's been 10 years, and I'm hoping maybe there's a set list floating around today.
I can tell you.
I've got it. I've got it right here.
For real?
Yeah,
right.
It's the album.
Of course not. Why would I? I'm
psych.
Every set list.
No.
From the last 10 years.
It's okay. Yeah. It's just been 10 years. It's fine.
But I can tell you, there is this crazy internet resource. There's a fan. No, it's really actually quite outstanding. You have to listen to the words I'm saying. They've already taken the mic away from you. So there's this thing, They Might Be Giants Wiki, and it will have not only the show you went to, but it might even have photographs, posters, and a scan of the very set list you had in mind.
It's extraordinary. Wait, were you onto this idea of playing albums in sequence earlier than most people? Because that's quite a common thing at the moment, isn't it? That people are doing classic albums.
Oh. Yeah.
I don't know.
We did.
I remember Sugar playing their album in sequence before we ever did, I think.
Well, they had one album.
They had only one album, but they played it in sequence. That was the thing.
I remember we played it once at the Ventura Theater, which is like kind of like a place in the middle of California where rock dies. And we were trying to figure out a way to make the show more interesting for everyone. Like, you know, if you were a fan coming from San Francisco or Los Angeles, it was for it was just on that Wednesday night or something. So we actually played our very first album in sequence. You know, this was, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. And we thought it would be like a real treat. And it completely left the crowd in the dust. I mean, they were just like, Why would you do that? We're deep inside side two, and they're just like, this sucks.
I think we've got somebody else with a question here.
I've got a couple of questions. I work with a lot of artists who are working on the self-release model. I'm wanting to know how you felt when you sold out so quickly of your super VIP club for the joiners.
Oh, sold out. When you said sold out, I thought we were going a different direction of this.
When you sold out so quickly. Buddy. And question number two is, will there be another kids album? Here Comes History, maybe?
The Here Comes History in the United States would be like a total cultural bomb. Like, it would just explode, like, so... I don't know. If we could get, you know, like, collaborate with, like, Howard Zinn's people or something and do, like, a People's History of the United States... I think that would be good.
The lowest selling thing of all time.
Yeah.
You've done different subjects, haven't you? Is that
We did. Yeah. It's they're very nice framing devices though, because you know it's like the ABCs is just about language. That's a pretty open topic.
Right.
You know, we did one about science, and even the science one, we weren't really on thin ice, but it made you aware of like how paranoid the times are because all the questions were like, oh, facts.
controversial.
You know, it was very depressing in a way.
I figure your core audience was the Tea Party, so.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, it was a project we did through Disney, and it's getting sold in all these in regular places where our records aren't normally sold. They're sold in like Targets and WalMarts and stuff like that. So we're kind of swimming in that.
Right. There were people from that world who were bitterly disappointed that we wrote a song about evolution on a science album. They were like, I can't believe I've been a fan for so long.
It was outrageous.
I'm so let down.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's the other thing is that you don't know who likes you, and you just put yourself out there, and when you do something like that, you quickly realize how many people just don't want to hear you talk about stuff like that. And it's hard because, you know, we're knee-jerk liberals from the Northeast.
And the question about the self-release model. Tell us what we were delighted.
It was great, actually.
Tell us what you've done. Well, we've done a lot of things, self-produced things over the year. Over the years, usually they're kind of humble, small failures. But the fan club thing was really a way to help just finance the final part of our album because we had gone much longer recording it and were rapidly running out of money. So,
in a way, the scary part of it was not that so many people bought into it, but that we have to now fulfill the agreement.
Yeah,
our end of the agreement, you know.
But it's a nice thing.
It's a serious point, isn't it? Because traditionally, record companies did all that stuff, didn't
they? Exactly.
Artists take on this stuff. Yeah. And it's a huge amount of work, isn't it?
I spent an hour yesterday stuffing plastic bags full of T-shirts and stickers. So
I don't know if you're joking or not.
I'm not joking.
You're not joking. Sort of in the van on the way here kind of thing.
Look at how tired I am, man.
No, seriously.
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm absolutely serious. Yeah.
So stuff like that, when people contact you, they're contacting you, your house kind of thing.
Well, not quite our house.
Okay.
Well, through the miracle of the internet, you get to keep your house very far away from
your
house.
But all this stuff is just causing more and more work, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a good, you know, it's good. I mean, this is good. I think the fan club thing is interesting because it also gives us a chance to, like, we did an EP that's coming out in August that's just some, like, super crazy songs. And got to release the Tesla song that wasn't on the Science record and that, so it'll come out.
Well, look, I'm sorry, that's all we got time for because we've got another speaker in here at 5 o'clock. But thanks very much, gentlemen, for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Harvey Giles. And please plug your new record. Your new record, which is out.
You can get the download at our website on the 18th or 19th, and you can buy it here in stores on like August 1st because I guess it got delayed somehow. I'm not sure why.
Thanks very much for coming along.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent every month.